So I have the great pleasure of introducing next speakers. Professor Christine Trinkin is Emerita Professor for International Law, Professorial Research Fellow and Founding Director of the Center of Women, Peace and Security at LSE, who's a member of Matrix Chambers and a Fellow of Academy. Together with Judge Hilary Charlesworth, she has really transformed our field with her pioneering work on feminist appropriation. Her article in the American Journal of International Law, together with Judge Charlesworth and Shelley Wright, is surely one of the most influential articles in international law and has really enabled us to see the field in a new light. Among her many accomplishments, Professor Trinkin was scientific advisor to the Council of Europe's Committee for the Drafting of the Istanbul Convention, and she is the recipient of the American Society of International Law, the Butcher Medal. She delivered the Hirshhorn Memorial Lectures in 2016. Dr. Mai Taha is Assistant Professor in Human Rights at LSE. She's an experienced teacher, having taught at Goldsmiths, University of London, the American University in Cairo, and York University, Canada. She's also a researcher of the highest order. Her work explores the different scales of revolution that draw out historical tension, arising workers' movements, feminist movements, and national liberation movements. She's developed this research in two key strands. The first engages with these questions in the context of international law, human rights, and international institutions, and the second engages with them in the context of labour and social reproduction, taking on the home space, the central site, theorisation, and critique. She's written insightfully on revolution, reimagining Bam Dong for women at work in Egypt, and has encouraged us to look beyond traditional sites and spaces, as with her work on human rights and communist internationalism on NGF Tour and the Syrian. Dr. Taha received her doctoral degree from Toronto under the supervision. And with that, I will hand over.
For that introduction, and thank you especially for arranging this very special event when we commemorate and celebrate Karen as a scholar, a friend, and someone who we all miss enormously. Now, we were assigned topics, and I was assigned gender and feminism and self-determination. And I think it's already clear from Marty's earlier lecture that these themes pervade Karen's work throughout. But what I'm going to do is take three scenarios that have figured in Karen's scholarship: the nationality of married women, the Tokyo Women's Tribunal, and the Women's Peace Camp at Greenham Common, and develop the notion of gender feminism self-determination through these three scenarios. Now, as we all know, as Judge Charlesworth has commented, international lawyers are known for how we revel in a food crisis or a grand episode, those episodes that skew the development of international law. The scenarios I have selected are not grand episodes. They are not international crises, but they are ones that challenge the patriarchal social structures of power that deny or at the very least limit self-determination for women. I'm framing the lecture following Karen, and in a concept that's already been mentioned by Megan, through the idea of encounters. And the encounters I am looking at are in three levels. So primarily, our shared encounter, Karen and myself, either in person or in writings and archives, with the women involved in the three scenarios that I'm going to describe. The second are my very special encounters with Karen when we worked together, and I had the very great privilege of writing and working with her. And through this, our third encounter with the biases of the patriarchal systems of international law. So I think it's very evident this is an intensely personal lecture. The encounters represent valuable memories of over 30 years of friendship, collegiality, professional collaboration with Karen. It began in a cafe in Toronto, I think in 1991. It continued through legal and academic events at the feminist site of the kitchen table, in restaurants, cafes, gardens, stations, airports, exhibitions, theatre trips. Karen always knew the best theatre in town and how to get tickets for that particular show. My revenge was football matches, where I don't think he was quite so enthusiastic about anything. And then through informal reading groups, and then latterly through Zoom conversations during lockdown at a time when I very much needed her friendship. Karen acknowledged that, to quote her, public international law is not typically described in terms of an encounter. And the three encounters may not be immediately recognized as relevant to self-determination. But Karen also said that the encounters with women are key to understanding better the self in self-determination, and is thus going to the very heart of what self-determination might mean for women, and more broadly to a gendered understanding of self-determination. Issues of identity and belonging, sexual autonomy and self-expression, decision-making at the international level in the context of global security. I think they also, and this is a point that Megan made earlier, highlight the importance of diversity, not only of diverse identities, but the diverse contexts in which the issue of self-determination be, even if it is not recognized as such by those involved in it. Diversity, of course, is now a commonplace concept, although, of course, we may also be seeing its disappearance with current politics. But I think it was much less prevalent when Karen wrote about it in Diversity and Self-Determination. So, to the three encounters. The first is on gendered nationality, again, something that has already been mentioned. But this was in our shared work back in the 1990s on the International Committee on Feminism and International Law, a committee of the International Law Association that was proposed by James Crawford, who asked me to be its chair and Karen to be its rapporteur. That's what led to the meeting in the cafe in Toronto. Karen was at that time his doctoral student in Cambridge, and exploring in her sort of history of self-determination, she was also looking at the emergence of the global women's movement at the time of the League of Nations. She was thus also delving into another related issue that mobilized women within the League, domestic nationality law that discriminated against married women. She proposed this as the first mandate for the newly established ILA committee, pointing out that it was especially apposite as one of the leading campaigners at the League, Crystal McMillan, had also appeared before the International Law Association in 1923, to urge the association to adopt the principle that women should have the same rights as men to choose their nationality. So from this as well, Karen was one of the first scholars to resurrect the forgotten women of international law, drawing on her feminist curiosity to ask, where are the women? Crystal McMillan was an early example of what we would now call a feminist lawyer and activism. Her activism in campaigns for the interrelated issues of women's suffrage and for peace coalesced with the concept of self-determination. Along with 1,000 other women in 1915, peace activists from across Europe and the United States, she attended the International Women's Congress at The Hague in 1915. So there they are, these amazing women of 1915. The women adopted a slew of resolutions that protested the madness and horror of war, recognized the right of people to self-government, and demanded equal political and civil rights for women. Since enjoyment of civil and political rights typically depends upon belonging to a state, that is, on citizenship, the issue of citizenship necessitates a preliminary inquiry. At that time, the laws in the majority of states followed the dependencies theory principle of nationality. That is, that on marriage to a foreign man, a woman lost her nationality or origin and acquired that of her husband. In the words of Sir Cecil Hurst, then legal advisor to the Foreign Office in 1923, our law in this country is founded on the principle that husband and wife are one, and that one is the husband.
Yeah.
This assertion of familial patriarchy meant, needless to say, that the reverse was not the case. Men did not lose their nationality of birth on marriage to a foreign wife. This inequality lies at the core of participation and identity, identified by Karen as key to self-determination. Who are you if you no longer hold the nationality of your birth, of your parents? You are now reduced to simply being a wife. If divorced, and hence potentially no longer holding either his nationality or that of your country of origin, you become stateless, a nobody, deprived of the nationality of your children and outside the protection of international law. Aaron details in Diversity and Self-Determination how the peace treaties that followed the end of World War I allowed women to vote in the plebiscites that they provided for. In her words, a watershed in that they were, for the first time, women were given the right to participate in an international expression of popular sovereignty. But this breakthrough also highlighted an incongruity founded on the socially constructed division between the public realm and the private, and assumptions about the place of women in the private realm. This is what was challenged by women like Crystal McMillan. The plebiscites assumed that there would be an automatic change of nationality for people within the territory where sovereignty was transferred following a majority vote. Provision was, however, made for people to opt out of that majority position and to exercise an individual decision with respect to sovereignty under which they would live. But this right of individual choice was not extended to the other scenario involving automatic change of nationality, that is, of a woman marrying a foreigner. In other words, while such a woman could participate in a collective right of self-determination by voting in the plebiscite, on marriage, a socially determined private sphere, she was denied the individual right of self-determination. Further, the decision to opt out of state sovereignty determined through the plebiscite was vested in the husband, who selected the citizenship of the family as a collective. The widely held conviction for familial unity with the husband, entrenched as decision maker, involved, again in Karen's own words, projections of competing relations between states onto the relations between husband and wife. The alternative of allowing the wife to retain her nationality and thus owing continued obedience to her own state might, it was feared, admittedly by the male elites of the day, that this would clash with her duty of marital obedience, while simultaneously creating a source of disloyalty within the state. The patriarchal proposition that all family members should share a common nationality harkened back to nationalism and presupposed warring relations at the level of the family and of the state. Critiques of it looked ahead to internationalism and peace. But states, of course, did not see nationality in married women as an equality issue, remained committed to, quote, the supremacy of the husband, seeking instead to avoid potential conflict between the nationality laws of different states and to promote legal uniformity. Despite continued campaigning for women's equality in nationality laws by Crystal McMillan and others through the Women's Consultative Committee of the League of Nations, and here is the Women's Consultative Committee of the League of Nations, Crystal McMillan is the one sitting in the middle, and she is very much a forgotten woman with the reservations recently. But the issue was not resolved during the lifetime of the League. It took the Commission on the Status of Women, established, of course, in 1946 as a full commission of ECOSOC, with responsibility essentially for development of women, to support corrective action through the 1957 Convention on the Nationality of Married Women. But despite that, and nevertheless, as Karen showed in her assiduous work on the ILA committee reports, inequalities continued. Article 9 of the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the CEDAW Convention, was a major breakthrough. It requires states to grant women equal rights with men in the acquisition, change, or retention of nationality, as well as with respect to the nationality of their children. But Article 9, among other articles of CEDAW, has incurred significant reservation. As recently as 2014, the CEDAW Committee reiterated to, quote, gender inequality persists in the nationality laws and practices of a significant number of countries and can lead to women becoming stateless. The Special Rapporteur on Racism has also taken up the issue, elucidating how patriarchal laws and gender-based discrimination in citizenship and nationality policy enable states to achieve racial, ethnic, and religious exclusions. Indeed, she says, an implicit aim of excluding married women from transferring their nationality to a foreign spouse is to discourage female nationals from marrying members of particular national, religious, ethnic, or racial groups. And the UN Working Group on the issue of discrimination against women has also highlighted that unequal nationality laws impact on the enjoyment of many other rights: equality in the family, participation in public and political life, freedom of movement, access to public services, economic and social rights to housing, health, and education. All are the very antithesis of self-determination for women. The League of Nations represented a liberal international world order based on national self-determination and international governance, making support for both principles seemingly compatible. Women campaigners at that time sought normative change at the international level, seeing the international as a new site for progressive and open thinking, where they could be freed from the conflicting of national government. They could appeal to the international as a source of liberation and the recognition of women's self-determination as equal in importance to national self-determination. The women, I would argue, embraced a far more expansive and progressive understanding of international law than their male counterparts. They viewed international law as regulating solely interstate behavior within the framework of state sovereignty and legal positivism, leaving domestic affairs, the private, strictly untouched by international law. So that's the first encounter. The second encounter has already, in fact, been touched on in some ways, and this is the continued injustices experienced by the euphemistically called comfort women, an issue that Karen and I discussed on many occasions, raising questions about rethinking international law so as to overcome the obstacles that prevent women from fully enjoying their right to self-determination. The feminist campaigners for equal nationality laws sought change through international legal order. But international civil society, for instance, transnational feminist activists, have also looked to alternative spaces for furthering international law, or at least identifying normative gaps. When there are no relevant institutions or existing institutions fail women, how might devising our own solutions, perhaps doing our own thing, prompt change? This was the case with the second encounter, the Tokyo Women's Tribunal, a people's tribunal that sought accountability for the wartime sexual violence committed by the Japanese military against the comfort women across Asia during World War II. The crimes were largely omitted from the trials carried out at the end of the war by the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, the INTFE. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, historians exposed the incidents of the comfort station. The now elderly surviving women began to recount their experiences to NGO investigators and to UN mandate holders, to write their own memoirs and commence lawsuits for reparation. But now that they were ready to speak out, the women found there was no international judicial forum through which they could receive justice, and the international law doctrine of immunity precluded any recompense through domestic litigation. So the Tokyo Women's Tribunal was the outcome of feminist transboundary networking and activism. It evolved from the vision of individual women across Asia who created a coalition of domestic and international legal practitioners, historians, scholars, activists, who participate in multiple ways over several years that culminated in proceedings held throughout a week in Tokyo in December 2000. 64 survivors of the military sexual slavery attended the tribunal, where many testified, speaking for themselves and to quote the judgment for an indeterminable number of girls and women who did not survive or who continue to live in silence. And this is a picture from the tribunal. The people here are the elderly women. You can see one who is obviously overcome with emotion at the testimony that she was given, and that was at the surrounding teams of lawyers and assistants. Oral testimony was supported by written and documentary evidence. Over 1,000 people attended the proceedings in Tokyo. It was highly confrontational and contested in Tokyo, especially as the proceedings were near the Yasukuni Shrine for military heroes in Tokyo. Following an initial judgment, a lengthy judgment delivered in The Hague, 12 months later. And this is the, get there? Yeah, this is the scene of celebration when the interim judgment was announced, and in particular that the tribunal convicted, in inverted commas, the People's Tribunal, the Emperor Hirohito for crimes against humanity against the Comfort Women. Karen did not actively participate in the Tokyo Tribunal, but she was deeply interested in it, and we worked together on a number of joint presentations relating to various aspects of the tribunal. The Comfort Women, but to Karen, self-determination is not only a struggle of peoples to become part of the sovereign states, but a struggle of individuals to have their stories brought into the international legal order. People's tribunals provide such a space where those who are silenced by law and mainstream politics can speak out and be heard. The Comfort Women were, of course, also denied any role in the post-World War II political and social reconstruction. The tribunal noted that in a far cry from the plebiscites, where women could vote, in the peace treaties in the 1950s, to quote, women either as individuals or as a group did not have an equal voice or equal status to men at the time of the conclusion of the peace treaties, with the direct consequence that the issues of military sexual slavery and rape were left unaddressed and formed no part of the background to the negotiations and ultimate resolution of the peace treaties. The tribunal considers that such gender blindness in international peace processes contributes to the continuing culture of impunity for crimes perpetrated against women in armed conflict, and thus again to the denial of self-determination. 55 years later, and exactly contemporaneous with the Tokyo Tribunal, UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace and Security stressed the importance of women's equal participation and full involvement in all efforts for the maintenance and promotion of peace and security, as well as accountability for perpetrators of sexual violence. But what intrigued Karen most about the Tokyo Women's Tribunal was that it was a very specific example of women doing our own thing. The tribunal was set up to judge the unpunished crimes against the Comfort Women, not simply as a civil society tribunal, but as if it were a reopening or a continuation of the official IMTFE. The latter could have prosecuted those crimes if it had made the connection between aggression and sexual enslavement, that the comfort stations were integral to Japan's military war plan for political and economic domination. But it did not. The women's tribunals constructed and acted as if it was the IMTFE, but an IMTFE that was prosecuting for and convicting the accused of sexual slavery as crimes against humanity. This act of going back in time and taking another path provides a counterfactual or alternative history, allowing speculation as to how events or law might have unfolded differently. The Women's Tribunal was, for Karen, a striking example of alternative history as a feminist practice, in that it provided a prequel to the story of prosecution of gender-based crimes of violence against women that is often presumed to commence only with the creation of the ICTY and ICTR in the 1990s. Thus, it questions how international law could have developed if this had happened. By backfilling the IMTFE, the Tokyo Women's Tribunal de-radicalizes later initiatives for bringing feminism, women's autonomy, gender justice into international law and institutions, presaging an alternative narrative of gradual but inevitable steps. Asserting women's autonomy, including sexual autonomy, would thus have been an important development for women's self-determination, well predating the colonial self-determination wave in the 1960s. The Tokyo Tribunal was then a challenge from the periphery, from women's civil society, exposing the exclusions and inequalities of international law, while also telling us what international law might have looked like if it had been the tribunal in 1945. In Karen's words, it would have helped change worldwide patterns of sexual stereotyping that continue to subjugate women. This would have constituted a step towards ending impunity, reversing the blatant disregard of the bodily integrity, inherent dignity, indeed, the very humanity of women particularly women of subordinated ethnicities, women from the margins, for whom self-determination remains just a myth. And through this strategy, there was a form of self-determination for all of us involved in the tribunal, including myself. But, of course, we cannot be too starry-eyed about the model. Karen herself was very aware of the limitations of the as-if approach, nor of people's tribunals that model themselves on and seek to apply the very law of the patriarchy that is the basis of oppression and subjugation. She observed, for example, that by applying the law in 1945, the tribunal was also bound by its inherent sexual and gender stereotyping, such as the requirement of the Hague regulations for respect for family honour, a provision that's been interpreted to prohibit rape, while presenting it as an injury to male honour rather than of egregious violence to women. Nor did the Women's Tribunal engage with the historical context of the racist and imperialist, as well as misogynist foundations and applications of international law. So excluding women and others from access to peace processes and denying them justice is not simply a matter of non-participation. It is erasure from the dominant historical narrative. So reimagining history and law as if women were there is a form of feminist activism that goes beyond static images, harnesses theories of social change. It's been described as prefigurative politics, a stance that entails a group adopting the structures and styles of reasoning that it seeks to promote, a modelling of the desired political and social outcomes through enacting the change you want to see. So the third encounter can also be seen as feminist venture, one that sought to suspend belief in the inevitability of current structures and that experimented with putting bold ideas into practice. The Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, established during the Cold War to protest NATO's decision to install US cruise missiles at the military base on Greenham Common, challenged traditional family structures, the gendered social roles of women and men, exclusionary international law decision-making, and in Karen's hands, reconfigured a domestic protest into foreign relations law. Greenham Common was encounter as protest, an extended example, it lasted from 1981 to 2000, of women's peace activism that dates back well into the 19th century. Women have long petitioned, campaigned, marched, occupied public space for equality, discrimination, and peace, incurring hostility, ridicule, and bringing the weight of the state down against them. The Greenham Women's Camp was spontaneous. It was an encounter that began when 36 women, 4 men, and various children commenced a 110-mile peace march from Wales to Greenham Common. On arrival, instead of dispersing, a group of women stayed and set up camp outside the airbase. The camp became settled as others joined or visited for longer or shorter periods. Karen described the airbase as representing how power works. She said, "The American military were there at the core, then the British soldiers, and then the police. Outside were this bunch of women, locked out, and who would periodically tear down the surrounding fence. Over the years, women blockaded the base and transports, used wire cutters to break in, hung teddy bears on the wire, and danced on top of the missile silo, making mockery of the concept of security supposedly engendered by nuclear power." In 1982, more than 30,000 women gathered at Greenham to join hands to embrace the base. And there they are, embracing the base. They aroused local, national, international hostility. Their non-violent direct action was responded to with abuse and violence from the media, local population, police, and bailiffs. In a microcosm of self-determination movements elsewhere, charges were brought against them of disturbing the peace and assaulting the police, when the real violence, of course, was directed against them through destruction of their property, physical abuse, strip searches, detention, and imprisonment. Many women were arrested and prosecuted, with cases on diverse legal and civil criminal issues proceeding through the higher courts. Doing their own thing extended into subverting all court proceedings, where women made personal statements, danced, and self-penned poems, somewhat bemusement of the authorities and the court. In the words of one of their counsel, they sang, at one hearing, they presented a case by way of the Gilbert and Sullivan opera. One fisherman and the others joining in. But the women also reverted to international law to justify their actions, for instance, by arguing lawful excuse to charges of criminal damage. Under the 1967 Criminal Law Act, a crime may be committed in order to prevent another crime. The Greenham women's actions were, they argued, to prevent the crime of genocide through nuclear annihilation. This was not accepted by the courts, but legal formalities sometimes did win. In another case, the then House of Lords ruled that bylaws passed by the Ministry of Defence criminalising trespass on Greenham Common were illegal, and hence convictions for trespass by the women had to be quashed. The former law lord put it, "It would be difficult to suggest a group whose cause and lifestyle were less likely to excite the sympathies and approval of five elderly," I add male, "judges." Yet it was five law lords who allowed the appeal and held that the minister had exceeded his powers in framing the bylaws to prevent access to common. Now, Greenham was the focus of Aaron's last work while she was at the LSE in 2019. In preparation for her forthcoming lectures at the Hague Academy, she contacted a number of former Greenham women and engaged with them, seeking accounts of the realities of life at Greenham, how it was determined to be a women-only space, how women from diverse backgrounds with differences of class, culture, sexuality lived together, how decision-making was carried out, how ordinary women became radicalised, and how beyond the physical encampment, it was also a set, to quote, "of connections across space between people and places, a network of women, an imagined community," again referred to earlier, "which stretched across Britain and beyond. While imagining a past for themselves embedded in the women's peace movement, Greenham women sought to build a new far-reaching community in a further form of self-determination at the personal and the national level." So Greenham captures in at least three ways issues pertinent to women's self-determination. First is the rejection of nuclear weapons. The inherent madness of these weapons was captured by Philip Allott. Quotes Philip, "In the Cold War, the two nations drove each other into more and more irrational behaviour, above all into a wildly hypertrophic accumulation of military weapons, those fetishistic props of troubled identity, like a fast car or a young mistress." But as Karen noted, Philip Allott did not clock the gendered implication of this. It captures so well, and now I'm quoting Karen, "the stereotype of the ring-a-ding-ding Western heterosexual male midlife crisis." And beyond the nuclear weapons, the gendered power dynamics of militarism, militarization, and imperialism that are embedded in political, economic, and social cultural discourse, and that rationalize the irrational, that it is the women, not the nuclear weapons, that constitute a threat to peace, stability, and order. Second is the methodology of Greenham as a women-only camp, an example of what Karen had earlier described as participatory collective autonomy. This decision was made in February 1982, was highly controversial and contested within the camp. But as Greenham women reflected some 40 years later, the view then prevailed throughout the lifetime of the camp, to quote the women, "men dominate space, verbally and physically, denying women the space they need to communicate freely, participate equally, make decisions, determine their own frames of reference and futures." It was a political decision that questioned the legitimacy of the structures that keep women subjugated. Once made, it allowed women to, again, quote, "develop tools for transformatory analysis and action." As a former Greenham woman put it, "I think we were very consciously trying to be different, have a sort of woman-dominated view of the world, a different power structure, trying to make decisions differently, behave differently. It was definitely about female empowerment." And then third, and picking on another theme that Aaron frequently returned to, could Greenham be called a feminist utopia? Unlike the plethora of fictional feminist utopias, Greenham was constructed women-only space, where women could live free from the pandemic of intimate male violence and the threat of such violence. The Women Seeking Equality Nationality Laws and the Tokyo Women's Tribunal did not seek to disrupt international law and institutions. They sought change in and through international law. In contrast, the Greenham Peace Camp was, again to quote, a liminal space, a created world where many of the rules and values of the rest of society were consciously questioned, reworked, transformed, or discarded in favor of a new set of beliefs. Greenham was outside normality, outside the real world. And in similar terms, the radically feminist world courts of women have been described as seeking to evolve new concepts of justice through, to quote, an unfolding of space, an imaginary, a horizon invites us to think, to feel, to challenge, to connect, to dance, to dream. It is an attempt to define a new space for women and to infuse this space with a new vision and new politics. The Greenham Peace Camp also extends thinking about self-determination, the vision of a different self-determination for women, considering gender and the importance of recognizing cross-cutting and intersectional identities. Greenham brought together women from diverse backgrounds, ages, class, sexuality, although very little racial diversity. A women-only camp directly challenged the gender binary through the very fact of the women's long-term presence there. Mothers become protesters, abandoning the private space of their homes and families for a very public space. Lesbianism and close relationships between women were normalized at a time when homophobia was rampant and lesbians were losing custody of their children, violent spouses. Gender fluidity was reflected in physical fluidity within the camp as locations and populations shifted, as women stayed, left, visited, shifted from one area of the camp to another. So collapsing the gender binary, recognizing the fluidity of gender, also leads us to question other hierarchies of power, including those that permeate the international legal system, lawful, unlawful force, combatant, civilian, international, domestic, war, peace, etc., and engaging a queer curiosity to exploit emancipatory paths for crafting change through international law. Greenham, of course, was not the utopia, although in the words of one journalist, women living communally on a massive scale must surely have been the best consciousness-raising group in the history of feminism. Greenham and women's courts, though, are models for tackling an oppressive, misogynist world, seeking a fairer one based on social justice and equality. When asked 40 years later what memory or feeling was evoked by women, was evoked by Greenham, women who were there repeatedly used one word, freedom. And so to finish, I'm going to turn to a fourth scenario, which is a contemporary incident of women living together, albeit in very different circumstances. This is northeast Syria, Rojava, where the slogan "Women, Life, Freedom" originated and is lived out today. In 2012, when violence was escalating in Syria, a Kurdish-led rebellion took over most of this area and in 2014 set up its own administration. They adopted a constitution enshrining gender equality, religious, cultural, and political freedom as inalienable rights for all residents, a political change spearheaded by Kurdish women whose personal freedom is linked with their reclamation of Kurdish identity, personal and national self-determination entwined. The Kurdish female fighters caught the attention of international media in the defeat of ISIS in 2014. Within Rojava, there is a village called Jinwa, which is inhabited by women and children alone, women without male partners, whose husbands have been killed in conflict, or women who reject marriage or are fleeing violent domestic situations. So we also have Jinwa, a community of women who are living and decided to create a free community life. It's an experiment, and of course, it's now a highly uncertain experiment in the changing, unstable environment in the Middle East, and especially, of course, in Syria following the fall of Assad. It's received no international recognition. It faces violence from the Turkish government. But the women living here have resisted the oppression of patriarchy, sought societal transformation through the lived ideas of freedom, equality and grassroots participation, signifying, I think, hope and hope for women's self-determination. I've deliberately not cited, I noticed nobody else has either, the classic international organization of self-determination and the right to self-determination, whereby all peoples freely determine their political status, freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. This somewhat bland definition does not capture that self-determination, as Karen emphasized, has always been seen as revolutionary. The women in the three encounters do not present as revolutionaries, although all pursued radical change. The women demanding equal nationality and law sought citizenship and legal status, albeit themselves were largely unique women. The comfort women were primarily young, poor women of multiple nationalities, caught up in the horrors of war, and who late in their lives wanted acknowledgement of the international crimes committed against them. The women who walked to Greenham were mothers concerned about their children's future and the future of the planet. They were not armed, they did not use violence, but were peace activists who sang, danced, lobbied in international courts and institutions, or created their own. Other women across the globe have used embroidery, tapestry, art, drama, erected statues, as we heard earlier, to assert autonomy, to resist and to memorialize their own denial of self-determination. The women in the women's protection units in Rojava are armed. They fought against a violent and misogynist movement that sought to destroy them. They present the question of self-determination movements everywhere. When is violence justified? A dilemma we discussed at length at a workshop while Karen was at the LSC in 2019. We do not have the lived experiences of women in Rojava who are asked to, quote, if women cannot defend themselves, what happens to them? Look at the women of Afghanistan, of Iran. We don't take up weapons out of the love of guns, but because we have to. But all these different actions must lead us to interrogate the concept of self-determination, because it is through interrogation that fundamental change happens. The fundamental change for all women of belonging on our own terms, of enjoying sexual and other bodily autonomy, a space and freedom to make our own decisions, free from the oppressive vectors of power enshrined in law, including international law. In their different ways, I would say all these women contested the image of constructed identity, demanded to be heard, challenged the model of reasoning that denied them self-determination. They were all revolutionary. And the encounters also demonstrate the continuity of women's histories that are obscured. They are linked by women's conceptions of peace during World War I, following World War II, at the height of Cold War, and finally resisting terrorism and extremism. The interlocking demands of women in The Hague in 1915 in Europe for suffrage, equal rights, peace, and self-determination. The comfort women's demands for inclusion into international legal processes intended to bring justice to those responsible for committing crimes against the peace. Demands that are still relevant to the Security Council Women, Peace and Security agenda. And the Greenham women, who drew on long feminist commitment to peace, non-violence, non-hierarchical methods of organization, and the Rojava women who were not prepared to see their constitutional progress destroyed by ISIS, who fought physically against rape, sexual enslavement, and elimination. In all of these encounters, women acted together, networking to challenge the patriarchy and the subordinate women. I think Karen would have cheered them all on. And in a quote used by her in her Hague lectures in 2021, one of the brilliant structural inventions of the peace movement as a whole is its combination of small affinity groups with large networks. In the small groups, you are known, valued, listened to. But instead of being an isolated enclave, the affinity group is linked to others in an international network which shares some, if not all, of the small group's goals. I think the small groups of women that I have described have between them enriched the concept of self-determination for women. And
good afternoon, everyone. It's such an honor to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation to kind of gather and honor Karen and her work. So I'm just going to go ahead and start. As mentioned before, I was her PhD student, and it's always really heartwarming to return back to her work and to remember her mentorship. Okay, so my talk today is also on ways of seeing. Megan had mentioned the gaze earlier, titled Ways of Seeing on the Gendering Work of Law and Violence. So in Karen's foreword to Emmy Talgren's Portraits of Women in International Law, which she titled Looking at Portraits, the image of the gallery is brought to life. Decades ago, she says, quote, feminist art historians could confidently write, it is no longer necessary to assert that there have been women artists. In international law, where the teachings of the most highly qualified publicists are the means of determining the law itself, the same cannot be said, close quote. True, the same cannot be said about international law, although perhaps also about art, but the key here is to observe Karen's ways of seeing. With a careful eye that often quite poetically captures international law's ailments and failures, she observed the discipline with the gaze of an art critic. Karen titled her foreword Looking at Portraits, a text that roams through the different chapters of the book in the same way one would inspect portraits while roaming around an art gallery, moving back and forth from one portrait to another, each telling their own story, but together, a one story of absence and disappearance. In the portraits, she observes that gender intersects with race, colonialism, class, sexuality, and other forms of difference. At the same time, she notes the old-fashioned epithet that one might attach to the idea of a portrait. After all, the portrait gallery metaphor partakes in canon building, which she rightly views as parallel with nation building and empire building. Indeed, the portrait is associated with elite culture, the subject of which is often an aristocrat sitting idly as a painter paints their portrait. And as Karen observes, the portrait gallery also evokes this imperial impulse to collect and catalog. Did it move?
Yeah.
Move here. In London's National Gallery, one can see this impulse vividly manifested in Hans Holbein's famous 1533 painting, The Ambassadors. But using the method of anamorphosis, which basically means that there's a distorted projection, which requires the viewer of the painting to occupy a specific vantage point to see something else than what initially appears, Holbein superimposes a skull. I went to see Holbein's painting several times, and in every visit, I noticed people in the gallery surrounding the ambassador. They move around, gazing at it from different vantage points, trying to see the skull from sideways. They're trying to see the skull, the image of death that overcasts the ambassador's life of kings and conquerors, as opposed to simply seeing the ambassadors with their colorful robes and artifacts. They're trying to see, to look differently at the portrait. It is through these different vantage points that Karen's eye invites us to look at it differently. We can only see the skull from a different position than the straightforward position one of a typical portraits gallery. Karen looks at portraits, and as John Berger has put it in his classic ways of seeing, quote, we only see what we look at. We never look at just one thing. We're always looking at the relation between things and ourselves. Our vision is continually active, continually moving, close quote. Within that spirit, Karen looks at the portraits in a way that centers the historical exclusion of women from the discipline. But importantly, this way of seeing is an invitation to see as a feminist would see. Seeing like a feminist does not simply mean seeing women, but about seeing what is hidden, seeing from the sideways, from the margins, from these different vantage points that makes one see the skull, not only the ambassadors. Karen shows how the exclusion of women has been historically connected to other exclusions, such as race and class, all of which are constitutive of international law as such. In that sense, we are never looking at just one thing, gender, but also at other forms of difference that have marked the history of international law and practice, a position that is articulated most cogently in her Diversity and Self-Determination in International Law book, where the concept of self-determination is not only tied to national self-determination, but one that is entangled with women's self-determination in post-war Europe, in settler colonial America, and in the colonized trust territories. Here, the category of self-determination conjures up several images that were absent from the canon of self-determination. And this is perhaps what Christine referred to today, of the topics that don't immediately suggest self-determination to an international lawyer. But for her, they are encounters that go at the heart of what self-determination might mean for women. And these that Christine had mentioned include issues of identity and belonging, sexual autonomy, self-expression, and in essence, the organization of international society. And I would also add issues of global capitalism and the international division of labor, as well as not only the organization of international society, but its very reproductions. So on what follows, and inspired by Christine's encounters with Karen, I kind of engage in four fragments, each trying to think with Karen's work on a methodological level on her theory. Compelled by contemporary world events today, I want to think specifically about ways of seeing Palestine through the gendering work of law and violence. Fragment one, traces, places. So in Christine's four encounters with Knopf, the complex gaze that constantly shifts to look at women as actors in and against international law comes up as we see the gendering work of law and violence. Again, we are always looking at the relation between things and ourselves. In that sense, the gaze shifts with the movement of time and space. In her preface, Looking at Portraits, Karen, the teacher who occupies the space of the university, observes rather prophetically, especially from our position today, that, quote, universities, like other spaces, are increasingly recognized as occupied. In Sarah Ahmed Stern's, she says, this occupation leaves traces on portraits of past leaders can surround you, leaving traces in places. Portraits of women in international law, Karen says, thus brings much a weighted change to the mental and potentially physical always of international law. As someone who also occupies the space of the university, I cannot read this today without thinking about the encampments that occupied universities across the country and the world, demanding divestment from Israeli genocide, apartheid, and settler colonialism, a moment that is undoubtedly reminiscent of the vibrant student movement against apartheid in South Africa. This also includes the hallways of these institutions. As many of you know, the University of Cambridge sought a court injunction to ban all Palestine-related protests at four university sites until the year 2030. They didn't succeed. So I cannot read this today without thinking about the violence that many of our students were and are subjected to because of their refusal to be complicit in this live-streamed mass extermination of Palestinians, along with the flattening of entire cities in Palestine. But importantly, also about the traces that these occupations leave within our campus walls. Traces of refusal. There are also traces that accumulate histories of violence, traces within what Karen has called the hallways of international law. One important trace that Karen erudite observed a lot in her writing is the gendered violence of international law and its institutions. Acting as the ruins of international law, violence does gendering work. We all saw the Israeli soldiers occupying the home space in Palestine. Many paraded Palestinian women's underwear over their military uniform, accessorizing with their weapons, mocking or perhaps celebrating this displacement of Palestinians and the dispossession of their homes and land. What kind of subjectivity is formed in these moments? What does this gendering work do in a colony? These are not specific questions, but one that speak to the more universal colonial condition. As Lisa Lowe shows, in the colonies, the patriarchal intimacy of the nuclear family, which turned on privacy, domesticity, and respectability, was intertwined with other disavowed spaces of intimacy. Sita Balani shows how in colonial India, these disavowed spaces of intimacy resided in the army barracks and the brothel, sites where the colonizer exercised their erotic fantasy of the colonized. In Palestine, these disavowed spaces manifest in the images we have been seeing of Palestinian wardrobes, closets, bedrooms put on display through this bizarre fantasy. Violence here does gendering work, posing questions about colonialism and psychoanalysis, ones that Fanon had persistently asked throughout his life. The colonizer's fantasy always entailed a gendered imaginary, from India to South Africa to Algeria and to Palestine. And international law is and has always been implicated in that fantasy. Fragment two, extraction. In the hallways of international law, we see the gendering work in Christine's encounter with Karen over the Tokyo Women's Tribunal and the chosen legal categories of the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, the IMTF. Such a long word, I can't believe. So the IMTFE at the end of World War II. In prosecuting defendants for crimes against the peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, the IMTFE implicitly partook in a tacit acceptance of the crimes committed against comfort women. As Christine was saying, by acting as if they were the IMTFE, the Tokyo Women's Tribunal, on the other hand, superimposed a different legal category, marking a different way of seeing the gendering work of law and violence. More concretely, Karen explains, in her work, the Women's Tribunal invoked the crime of sexual slavery as opposed to the older description of them as enforced prostitution. Sexual slavery captures some of the extent and scale of rapes and sexual violence committed against the comfort women. Perhaps one might also argue that while sexual slavery might better capture this form of violence, it also abstracts from the material conditions of this violence, and importantly, its temporality. Indeed, international legal categories will always abstract from the reality of violence and from the historical structures that make this violence possible. Something gets hidden when atrocity is categorized as an international crime. It is unable to capture the complexities of the unfolding of violence over time. International crimes merely seize snapshots of spectacular violence, but not the mundane, slow violence, let's say, of capitalism and settler colonialism, which require persistent critical inquiry to be able to really see how it operates and how it changes and moves over time. To put it simply, international crimes abstract from the movement of time, from history. The conversation around the mere categorization of what Israel is doing in Palestine as genocide corners us into a rather politically petty bond, especially as compared to the horrors we see every day on our little screens. The ICJ itself, in its provisional measures decision, said that what Israel is doing to Palestinians constitutes a plausible genocide. And some really like to hold on to that. It's only a plausible genocide, not genocide itself, as if somehow the latter is more tolerable than the former, as if when you call it plausible genocide, it means something less reprehensible than the extermination of tens of thousands of Palestinians. True, some international crimes and legal categories are able to capture the violence better than others, but none are able to escape the abstraction of the courtroom. Papers, lawyers, journalists, arrest warrants, all this drama to find evidence, to gather the forensics, to prove something that we already know. Israel, along with the unwavering support from almost the entire Western world, has killed at least 48,000 Palestinians, displaced 1.9 million people in Gaza within 15 months. During the same period in the West Bank, there have been more than 1,800 settler attacks on Palestinians. The Israeli military has killed at least 894 Palestinians and displaced 40,000 people in the West Bank and East Jerusalem just in this last 15 months. But importantly, none of the international legal categories can ever capture the unspectacular violence of settler colonialism in Palestine that seeps into the everyday. It doesn't capture the experience of Palestinian male, and here the gendering work is interesting, Palestinian male construction worker going to work in Israeli settlements, a baffling cycle of violence that forces the Palestinian worker not only to partake in the enrichment of the colonizer boss, but also literally construct his own destruction by building the very colony that dispossesses him of a home and a land. Here, labor exploitation has new meanings. It is an exploitation that not only partakes in the accumulation of capital, but one that is embedded within an infrastructure of dispossession. International legal categories don't capture the carceral regime of movement in the colony, from checkpoints to settler-only roads to the vast bureaucratic apparatus of ID classifications. It also doesn't capture the day-to-day infiltrations into the Palestinian home, breaking pots and pans, soiling blankets, pouring olive oil on the floor, all of which is constantly cleaned again and folded back to the mundane order of a household by Palestinian women, reversing the show of colonial violence that constantly invades the home place. All this constitutes the infrastructural basis of the spectacular violence we have been witnessing for the past year and a half. The snapshots that international law seek to capture are mere snapshots within a long history of colonialism. This holds true for sexual slavery, the basis of which is also the long-term Quotidian functioning of patriarchy, from the mundane division of labor and unpaid housework at home to the horrors of sexual violence in times of war. Sorry, I can't see here. Yeah. Fragment 3, the human. So there are some voices that quickly resort to citing statistics of violence against women and children, an act that almost always obfuscates any conversation about politics, about history. They're repurposing the old Victorian trope that puts women and children in the same category. Not only does this trope infantilize women as weak and in need of guidance, casting a humanitarian lens onto what is clearly a political situation, but it also does a lot of gendering work. By casting women as fallen victims in this genocide, it demonizes and dehumanizes Palestinian men and anyone who struggles against Israeli settler colonialism, including women. As Karen shows in her writing, the gendering work is not only about women. Here, it's also about the constructions of femininity and masculinity. The former maps onto victimhood, and the latter maps onto the disposable, unhuman body that the Israeli war machine reserves every right to kill. Indeed, Israeli state officials were quick to publicly announce that they were fighting human animals in Palestine. While, of course, an outrageous statement, it is broadly consistent with the history of international law, which has so comfortably relied on civilizational hierarchy that deemed some people human and others not so much. International law always had its outsiders. In fact, law more generally has historically played a distributive role in its granting of humanity. Tamer Esmir has argued that humanity is granted in and through law, or what she calls juridical humanity, which necessarily implies that humanity could also be withdrawn in and through law. In her critique of colonial law, one becomes human through the juridical form. Here, there's a recall of Fanon's monologue in The Wretched of the Earth, when he mocks the colonizer's evocation of zoological terms in describing the colonized. But as Fanon reminds us, quote, "The colonized know all that and roar with laughter every time they hear themselves called an animal by the other, for they know they are not animals, and at the very moment when they discover their humanity, they begin to sharpen their weapons to secure its victory." Close quote. Fragment 4, ways of seeing the resistance. Diversity and self-determination poses the question of what happened to emancipatory struggles when they were reformulated under a right to self-determination in law. Self-determination would bring, as Karen argues, a counter-hegemonic flair to international law. Through a global anti-colonial and largely socialist movement that made the birthing of newly independent states possible, the UN General Assembly was forced to reckon with colonialism through a right to self-determination. But it was eventually constructed through a statist understanding of liberation, the outcome of which we see in the nightmare of the post-colonial state, and we already see in the Palestinian Authority and its fictional two-state solution and the Oslo regime. In other words, once incorporated into law, self-determination's revolutionary possibilities were curtailed or perhaps foreclosed altogether, at least after. In Christine's encounters with Karen, there's a sense of refusal of an international law that continues to foreclose emancipatory possibilities. From people's tribunals to feminist direct action and occupations, the encounters bring about all these sites of tension with the discipline. Karen's ways of seeing direct us to experiences that refuse to engage in rebuilding the canon, but those that can cross the adage canon in and of itself. This is an image from 1987 of women, 1987 in the first Intifada in Palestine, of women defending homes through different ways. And obviously the scene is rearticulated today in various ways, where the home is not only being defended, but is actually remade every time there's a displacement over and over again. So instead of simply changing the faces in a portraits gallery, seeing like a feminist would direct us instead to the galleries, and this is a quote from Karen, quote, back rooms or basement housing the permanent collection, not only on display, but also beyond the building, the altogether unportrayed, close quote. It directs us to see what is hidden, what is obfuscated. Seeing like a feminist, I think, is also a way of seeing refusal and resistance amidst all the ruins of law and violence. Thank you.